This is Earshot. I'm David Rutledge, and you're listening to the sound of thousands of bats roosting in a rare rainforest at Wingham in New South Wales. This is our destination today in part two of The Other Green Army, a documentary tracing the evolution of bush regeneration in Australia. Wingham was the scene of two battles that were pivotal to the movement's development. First, there was a battle against a weed invasion so enormous that trees were disappearing beneath the sheer weight of exotic vines. Secondly, though, there was a battle of minds, which briefly caused a split within the bush regen movement and eventually redefined how they went about their work. The Other Green Army is presented and produced by Nick Franklin.
The grand Australian bush, nurse and tutor of eccentric minds, the home of the weird and of much that is different from things in other lands.
Wingham, just a little inland from Taree on the mid-north coast of New South Wales, is a special place. Famed for its colony of flying foxes and the bush they call the brush, Wingham Brush. The day I visit the brush, it's the cicadas I hear before the bats. And their sheer intensity seems a metaphor for the row that broke out here. The trigger was the arrival of a young American immigrant, a man who was to change bush regeneration for good, although he had no idea of this at the time.
My wife heard on the radio about calls for volunteers to work in the brush to fix it up. In fact, that's one reason why I came here, is just attracted to the rainforest right in the middle of town with these huge bats flapping about in it, and I thought this was my kind of a place. She put my name down, and so I can blame it all on her.
In the 1970s, if you wanted to see how devastating weeds could be, Wingham Brush was the place to go. Madeira vine, cat's claw creeper thrived in the alluvial soil. The vines growing rapidly up into the canopy, totally smothering the trees, so that this rare piece of rainforest was disappearing altogether.
The brush is about 10 hectares of lowland subtropical rainforest on alluvial soil. There's thought to have been, in the late 1970s, less than 100 hectares left in the state, because nearly all of it was cleared for agricultural pursuits very early in settlement. It's extremely rare, extremely rare.
Extremely rare and worth saving as part of our bush heritage. Cue the National Trust.
National Trust was formed in 1945, and right from those early days, the idea was that it would be involved in countryside, conservation, management of the countryside. It was modelled on the English National Trust. The English National Trust owns a third of the coastline of England and manages it in a whole lot of countryside, and so the idea here was a similar approach.
Graham Quint, today the National Trust's Advocacy Director, back then a young bush regenerator. By the time the Trust arrived at Wingham, it was well established as a major player in bush regeneration, particularly in Sydney, where it had successfully converted councils to the benefits of the Bradley Method. And that was to be the deal at Wingham.
That's right. We were hired to put the Bradley Method into place at Wingham Brush. We became students of it. We had to learn about it. Megan and I were taken to Sydney, learning about the Bradley Method on site.
Exactly what was meant by the Bradley Method in those days was spelt out very precisely by the Trust's Evelyn Hickey, interviewed by the ABC at Wingham back in 1982.
Well, there are three very important principles, and these we've found that you cannot deviate from at all. The first one is...
No deviation were the key words. And that was to spell trouble for John Stockard when he found that the Bradley Method simply didn't work at Wingham Brush.
It just didn't fit the bill, okay? There are huge differences between the tillity of the ground here versus that in the Sydney sandstones, and the weed growth rates were phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. We'd have, and redwood would grow a meter a week. You just turn your back on it.
Is that the Madeira vine?
Madeira vine, yes, yeah. Okay, the same thing. And it would grow that rapidly, and we also had cat's claw creeper.
Cat's claw creeper, also known as yellow trumpet vine. Origin, South America, uses ornamental.
High nutrient soils, water, high temperatures. The growth rate of those vines was just enormous. There's no way even a really large team could have kept up with their growth rate. teetering on the brink of complete collapse. The vines were right over the tops of the trees. They couldn't photosynthesize. They were dying. Given another 5 to 10 years, the system would have died.
Joan Bradley tried alongside of us, and we'll keep digging down this far, see what happens. And of course, it just kept springing up, and it became pretty obvious we couldn't use manual techniques. Joan Bradley herself introduced various herbicides for us to try.
Teen McDonald clearly remembers how Joan Bradley's attitude was changing, becoming out of step with some of her more ardent disciples.
Absolutely. She was trialling the use of certain herbicides, and that was even typed into her original book, Bush Regeneration. And I recall my own copy had a piece of paper glued over that section. So obviously that there were some quite strident anti-herbicide people who were supporting Joan, and after her death that became the rule that herbicide was not preferred.
If you don't use poison on big weeds, it takes ages, doesn't it?
It does. Indeed it does, yes.
Can you remember before you used poison?
Yes. Well, no, I remember Norma Stewart, the first day she started with the Bradleys, taking out a giant one-story high privet, which she worked on, I do remember, for 3 weeks.
3 weeks?
We're trying to get the roots out of the ground. You know, you had to actually dig out the
everything
roots.
Everything by hand?
Everything by hand.
And no poison?
No poison.
But then Roundup or glyphosate came in, and she could see it could be injected straight into the trunk and not sprayed. She was totally against spraying, and some of those early herbicides before glyphosate were really terrible, you know, 1080 and all of that. So when she could see this much safer and only a very small amount applied, she was interested in using that in a limited way.
My understanding was Joan was certainly experimenting with using poison herself. She was open to it. But I think things came to a head with what happened at Wingham, wasn't it?
Well, it's interesting because Wingham Brush Bush Regeneration Project came in the early 80s, led by a dental surgeon by the name of John Stockard. And he was a brilliant man, who developed an adaptation of the Bradley method that used herbicide to a great deal higher extent. The operators there were using spray packs, or at least John was, to great effect, actually. It was challenging for the National Trust, who were the contract holders at the time.
So why did the Trust sack John Stockard and that team?
Well, at the time it was quite controversial, and we were concerned because that was really the opposite of what we had not only been using in the Sydney bushland area but what we'd been teaching. So we found it quite radical, and yeah, it did lead to quite a difficult situation.
So they were concerned on two fronts, the use of herbicide and also about over-clearing. One of Joan Bradley's principles was that you clear only to the extent that the native plant community can regenerate. There's no point having large areas of weed response that you can't manage.
In the end, they sacked us, okay? They sacked us for not applying the Bradley method at Wingham Brush, and because of our departures from that method, despite our support from people like Alec Floyd and all the major environmental experts in rainforests.
So this got pretty feisty then?
Very, very, very feisty, okay. They tried to form team by transporting members up from Sydney, from the North Shore cliques. We had demonstrations here, and we said, no trusts, go home. It was a very, very hard time.
You were talking about the North Shore people, but mm-hmm. You had locals against you as well, didn't you?
Yes, we did. We had the alternate society. We were very organized, and they were connected here, there, and everywhere through their little ground networks. And, they were, because of the chemical issue, they were very opposed. And also, I think the legacy of Monsanto and Agent Orange and Vietnam, anything to do with that must be wrong, had to be opposed. And
which you could sort of see it.
Of course.
I mean, you could see where they're coming from.
Of course you could see it.
One of John Stockard's local critics was Chris Sheed, who'd produced a mini-documentary on community radio questioning the use of poison at Wingham Brush.
Well, the person who was conducting the activities at the Wing and Brush was apparently very upset. The radio station at the time had done a number of benefit concerts on the riverbank adjacent to the Wing and Brush. We had another one planned, and the leader of the Wing and Brush regeneration team...
This was John.
..put in an objection to the council.
On the grounds...
On the grounds that the concert would disturb the bats. There had been numerous efforts in the past to get rid of those bats. I love the bats. I have no problem with the bats at all. But they tried everything, fire, grenades, shootings, poisonings. Of course, they're now a protected species, but they are still under threat. Well, I think council realised that the concert was unlikely to disturb the bats. The council declined. I think actually John, bless him, went as far as planting some trees on the site to try and stop us. But the concert did go ahead, and we sent a donation to the Wing and Brush Regeneration Group. It was only $100, but that probably wasn't an insignificant amount at that time, and unfortunately it was returned.
Yeah, but see, everybody blames me for doing it. It was Pat McNeil's idea to plant the trees there, okay? And she was a housewife, so...
But you supported the idea.
Oh, of course, we all supported it. Everyone in the team supported. We all acted in concert with one another. So, yeah, and I think it did put them in a bad place because it put them in the invidious position of protesting against the planting of trees. We thought it was really rude. I was really always taken aback. I said, you call yourself nature reserves, and you sit there and hold rock band concerts right next to animals like flying foxes and possums and everything with their sensitive and delicate ears, and you think that's all right, Jack?
He says he sent you a check later and you sent it back.
Yes, I did send it back. Yeah, I did. We did. We sent it back. And, you know, wouldn't have anything to do with them because then it was really a matter of subscribing to their activities that we were opposed to, and it couldn't be bought off that cheaply.
I wonder, in hindsight, whether you think, well, if it hadn't been someone like him, maybe the work wouldn't have been done.
Oh, look, I have tremendous respect for John and what he achieved in the Wing and Brush. It was fantastic, and the evidence today is a great legacy for what he has achieved. There's little doubt about that. Many people, and many people still have concerns about the use of Roundup, but, you know, looking back, it probably couldn't have been done. The Bradley method wouldn't have been practical. I don't think John and the rest of the team crawling around on their knees really would have been effective.
Although sacked by the National Trust, John Stockard and his team had continued to work at Wing and Brush as volunteers.
It split bush regeneration completely. So in those days, there was going to be two organisations of the Bradley Bush Regeneration Association, something like that anyway, and then the Australian Association of Bush Regenerators, who wanted to see bush regeneration as something that was growing.
We wanted to take over the whole of Australia, I suppose, and bush regenerate. So this was a way of getting together.
The association was, yes.
So that worked well. But there were two associations for a while, which was a bit of a...
Was that...
Well, we had the meeting. Yes, it was. We had a meeting to start an association, and some didn't want to and some did. And, of course, at the meeting, it was got a bit heated. Some of us went out in the car park afterwards and someone said, well, we're going to have an association. So we stood there and we had our meeting in the car park and we decided that we'd have an association and the next day that Janet Fairley Cunningham would go into the wherever you register associations at 9 a.m. and register the association, which she did.
And that was the beginning of the Association of Bush Regenerators.
Yes, but she, as she was leaving, she found the other group there starting their associations.
So what was the difference between the two? What was it about?
Progress, I suppose.
The practice of bush regeneration had become somewhat dogmatic.
Tean McDonald is the current president of the Australian Association of Bush Regenerators.
This is 1980s?
This is early 1980s, and, of course, in the early development of a technique, one should not become closed about new ideas. And different ecosystems have different responses. The traditional bush regeneration was practiced in a gum tree sclerophyll ecosystem, whereas in a rainforest, the ecological processes are somewhat different.
I had just nightmares. You'd wake up entangled in vines at night, you know. You just really, for years, I think there was a huge amount of pressure to to see if you could actually beat these vines. The most stressful part was the battle with the factions, with my fellow species of apes. I found them absolutely bewildering. And I think there was a certain cultic aspect to the early Bradley method.
Do you think, incidentally, that some of Joan Bradley's followers were purer than Joan?
Absolutely, yeah. You know,
because funny enough, Joan came up here, as you said, and was actually advising you on the use of poison.
Absolutely. She introduced it, and she had wrote a letter to our team saying that she was very pleased with the results, and she would have to revise her earlier gloomy prospects for how long it would take to restore the brush.
So the sad thing was, in a way, that she was towards the end of her life, then, wasn't she?
Yes, it didn't work to our favor. Her demise did not help us, because when she was gone, it came back to the dogma people and the control people. But we were just naturally disobedient. we weren't very obedient people.
John Stockard was one of the bush regeneration pioneers, in my view, and a hero. Many people would have looked at that ecosystem and said, this has no future. But John Stockard, bit by bit, would remove vines from around trees that were like telegraph poles, and they would recover. The vegetation around them would recover, birds would visit them, bats would visit them, and new species were brought into the ecosystem. He has shown that we can adapt methods. If we understand the basic principles, we can adapt methods to the needs and scale of the site.
Eventually, the National Trust, which had sacked John Stockard, changed itself, appointing a scientific committee and a new director. With them came a new direction, a dual approach to bush regeneration.
So the whole idea from that point on was to come to grips with the two opposing ideas, concepts, and to decide which way the trust should go now.
So did the trust actually change its direction?
Mm. Oh, yes, yeah. I mean, basically the scientific reporting coming back to us from that committee was there are some bushland reserves where you could use the traditional methods quite effectively. There are other areas where you had massive weed infestations, a bit like Wingham Brush. You really had to go in and deal with that, because otherwise you would just never, ever be able to regenerate the bushland at the core.
Joan Bradley had died in 1982, her sister Eileen 6 years earlier. Both women had made a tremendous contribution to the evolution of bush regeneration.
After a recent weeding session in Ashton Park, Joan and Eileen Bradley talked with reporter Jim Revitt.
Well, it's essentially a program of helping the natives to battle the weeds.
Sketch of Joan, my first word is going to be she was really scary. She seemed to know everything and she had very strong opinions. She was really good at sharing her knowledge, but she wasn't very nice if we made a mistake and we accidentally pulled out a native instead of a weed. We've all got stories of of thinking, whoops, we've done the wrong thing, and hiding the mistake so we didn't get spoken to.
Because if you start where the weeds are worst and work towards the bush, you bring the weeds with you. If you do it the opposite way, you bring the bush with you.
But an incredible legacy.
Oh, an incredible legacy. I mean, it's still called the Bradley Method. She got it out and around. Bush regeneration simply wouldn't have existed without her. So, a great legacy.
Do you plant shrubs and flowers? No, this isn't necessary.
Because she said to me, I heard her one day, she said, I'll be 65 soon. And I thought, oh, I thought 65 was as old as the hills then. And I thought, oh, you're feeling your age. And I organised a 65th birthday party for her in Batten Reserve, and that was lovely. Everybody came from all over. And she died not long after.
Do you both find it satisfying work? Gorgeous. Immensely satisfying, yes.
Meanwhile, bush regen continued to grow, thanks in large part to the publication of a book which was to become hugely influential, despite its almost casual beginnings.
It was one of those conversations one has round the photocopier. The boss at Ryde TAFE said, Robin, would you like to write a book on bush regeneration? And at that stage, I was young, poor, needing any work I could get. I said, yes, I said.
Robin Buchanan's Bush Regeneration, Recovering Australian Landscapes was published in 1989.
But you're being a bit modest. That was actually used as a manual for some of the early students who went to TAFE.
Yes, it was. And I mean,
what was it really seen as an industry in those days?
It was by a narrow group of people seen as an industry, but a lot of people just saw it as weird volunteers. It is still sometimes seen that way. But the book developed into something quite large. TAFE then decided to distribute it in bookshops. So it went round Australia.
Natural areas are important. They provide us with practical services such as clean air and water and control erosion and insects. They also give us the simple pleasures of interacting with a rich and diverse world. Their conservation and restoration need to be carefully balanced with production and development, as overexploitation leads to degradation of both natural and developed areas. Dust storms and contaminated water benefit no one. Restoring Natural Areas in Australia. Robin O'Buchanan.
A book established it, I think, as a legitimate industry. It was something that really existed, and I think that was the real takeoff of bush regeneration around Australia.
Not so, just something done by rat bags on a...
Not just something done by fringe greenies, that's exactly right.
As the word spread, more and more people joined up, both as paid workers and volunteers. All sorts of people were getting involved for all sorts of reasons.
Back in the early 80s, when my children were in primary school, Mother Flying Fox lost her baby and it landed in the school playground. I ended up being taught how to care for this flying fox and reared it, and it became part of the family for a few months until it had to go off to be released.
For Nancy Pallon, that flying fox was just the beginning. For 30 years, she's devoted thousands of hours to recovering and protecting what is now Ku-ring-gai Flying Fox Reserve in Sydney.
So, Nick, the reserve's 15 hectares, but the flying foxes, they were in the western part, right up against a nursing home back in the 60s and 70s. And then they've gradually, as they wore the trees out there, they've kind of moved. We've taken away a lot of their foraging habitat in rural areas, completely removed it. As the flying foxes are now camping more in cities, they are restricted to quite small reserves. Ku-ring-gai Bat Conservation Society was formed in 1985, and the volunteer team, I think over the years it's more than 150 people have spent time on this project.
Clearly the volunteers are important.
They are very important because I think without the volunteers and the society putting pressure onto the council and applying for grants in the early days, in the 80s and 90s, we obtained quite large environmental grants to employ contract teams to work in the reserve.
So you've been going over 30 years. Yeah. And there's still work to do.
Oh, yes, yes. And if you talk to any other bush regenerator, they'll say there's plenty more. Unfortunately, one of the problems is that weeds remain on private property and people are quite loath, in fact resistant, to removing some of the weeds on their land. As we walk along here, just look around, Nick, it was not possible to walk through this part of the reserve back in the 80s.
Well, I was going to say, 90s. Nancy, where are the weeds? But
well, exactly. We've removed them. And I have to say, in addition, the wallabies have pruned anything that they can reach. So the understory is quite open, which it used not to be. But this was chock full of morning glory, wandering dew, privets, you name it. It was here. Oh, lantana. Just sure.
And now you can see, well, turpentine soaring straight up, and you can see the sky. That's and the canopy is good.
It is. This area has recovered and is getting stronger every year. People told me back in the 80s that there's no way you could achieve that. Fortunately, this wonderful man up at Wingham, John Stockard, and his wife Stephanie and some of the local people, they got stuck into looking after Wingham Brush. He just said, look, you can just do it. Just start. And so we did.
Ah, seen one. Oh, one, two. There's a lot.
Yes, the last count was 25,000, roughly. You can see how they like to camp. They hang in the trees.
I mean, I'm looking at one over there. I can't see what sort of tree at this distance, but there would be probably hundreds in that tree.
Oh, there would be. That's right.
All hanging upside down.
Yeah. I mean, bats are the only mammals that can fly. They're just absolutely fascinating. And watching them take off at dusk is one of the joys, really.
Okay. So about 2 years ago, the area within this path was given a control burn.
The 50th anniversary celebrations for the Mossman Parks and Bushland Association on Sydney's North Shore included a guided tour of the site and mention of one of the touchiest subjects in the bush.
So the Bradley sisters, when they started their bush regeneration and they noticed that fire had gone through, apart from the natives responding to this benefit, the weeds responded too. So this is where I do a lot of my work here in this area. So after the fire went through, the weeds that started to shoot were very obvious, and we were able to get in and knock them out to give the native plants a competitive advantage. And that's the secret of the Bradley method.
It was always half on fire. Fire made it, and in doing so, disposed it to burning. For several million years, lightning amply satisfied that need, until the Aborigines arrived and in time made fire a way of life. The Bush by Don Watson.
The use of fire as a tool in bush regeneration was one of the main changes, one of the milestones in bush regeneration. Ecosystems that are adapted to fire may need fire to be applied as part of the restoration process. In bush regeneration, we only use fire in small areas.
If the short history of bush regen is anything to go by, there'll always be strong, feisty characters about to fight the weeds. Far too many to give proper credit to here. The spirit, drive and commitment of the Bradleys lives on, and today new generations of bush regenerators are doing battle with new generations of bush invaders. And in finding new ways to fight the fight, they're incorporating some of the very oldest techniques used by humans.
In northern New South Wales, there's a property, an Indigenous protected area called Minyamai, where the Indigenous rangers who are reinstating fire in small areas, and they're relearning traditional practices, how to patch burn safely in a modern environment.
On RN, you've been listening to The Other Green Army, a history of bush regeneration. That was produced and presented for Earshot by Nick Franklin with sound engineer Timothy Nicastri. Stephen Tilley read extracts from Don Watson's latest book, The Bush, and you can find details of all the people in today's program with links to more information about bush regeneration on the RN website. Just go to abc.net.au/RN and look for Earshot on the drop-down menu. And of course, you can also download a podcast of all our Earshot programs on the website. I'm David Rutledge. You're listening to RN.